Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, what does a fishing hook have to do with Quebec's new archbishop and the new evangelization? Stay tuned to find out. We'll also hear from a new Canadian cardinal about why faith matters in the public square. And with more than 5 million visitors in the last year, what challenges lie ahead for the Vatican museums? Dioceses around the world are preparing for the Year of Faith, which kicks off October 11th, focusing on the new evangelization. The year, running to November 24th, 2013, will focus on how to present the gospel in areas which were once strongly Christian. One such area is the Canadian province of Quebec, which was once seen as the Catholic bedrock of North America. However, in recent years, it has become more and more secular. In 2011, Quebec City received a new archbishop, Gerald Lacroix, who has been using modern means of communication like Facebook and Twitter to evangelize. Besides wearing the cross that his name implies, Archbishop Lacroix also sports a fishhook on his lapel, something that Sean Patrick Lovett finds out in this interview is a symbol of his mission in Quebec. Sean began by asking Archbishop Lacroix about the role that secular institutes can play in the church and the new evangelization today.
Well, you see, for many, many centuries, if you wanted to consecrate your life to God, you either became religious, a priest, a nun, a monk. But in the last centuries, we've seen more and more people wanted to continue to be lay men and women in the midst of the world, in their working profession, but consecrated to God. And so in 1947, Pope Pius XII, more than 60 years ago, it's new and yet not that new. Well, of course, if you look at 2,000 years of history, it's fairly new, recognized this special vocation. And so there are over 200 institutes in the world right now, men and women. Most are lay people. Some are priests, who live out their vocation through their profession in the midst of daily life. So they have no habit. They need to be vested in charity and love and service and justice, like all Christians, but are called to a special vocation.
Now, you are particularly close to secular institutes, and you have a special perspective on them because of your own experience with the Pius X secular institute. How has that shaped your understanding of what these institutes can do?
Well, seeing a secular institute from the inside, being a member of a secular institute, is very different from learning out of books or seeing other people. I was 18 years old when I joined the Pius X Secular Institute as a layman. I was working in restaurants, then I was a graphic designer. I was in the working world, never thought I'd be a priest, let alone a bishop and an archbishop. And I was very happy to be a witness of Christ in the working world by my presence, by trying to live in a very high degree the gospel of Jesus Christ and being a witness to my fellow co-workers. And I grew in that vocation. And later on, when I was 25 years old, you see, many years later, I discovered that I was called to the priesthood and began. But my studies and all of that. But I would say that the experience of being in the working world gives a whole new perspective to one's life. Being in dialogue with that reality, you know, living like ordinary life, like everyone. Mm-hmm. Not having a community that backs you. Of course, we belong to a group. Every institute has its ways of bringing people together, either once a week, once a month, for recollection, for sharing, for prayer, to support each other. But it's quite a challenge to be out there.
Certainly. And in terms of challenges, that title, Primate of Canada, that's quite a challenging title. It's a very onerous title as the new Archbishop of Quebec. Now, if we look back at the history of Quebec and we see this wonderfully Catholic city, very vibrant, very energetic, very alive with Catholic Christian tradition, and we look at it today, the city that is now under your pastoral care, the challenges are enormous. What do you see as some of those challenges, and how do you intend facing them?
Well, you know, the church, not only in Quebec, but in North America and Europe, is in need, and the Holy Father has stressed this now for all his pontificate, and Pope John Paul II also, is in need of new evangelization. That is the big challenge right now. We have a lot of people who identify themselves to the Christian culture, Judeo-Christian culture, who have roots, who have some knowledge of it, but need to deepen their faith. Being baptized or receiving First Communion, or some of them receiving the sacrament of marriage, confirmation, is one thing. But having a deeper faith, a better relationship with the Lord, and living truly as Christians is quite a challenge. That is the challenge that is before us now, I would say. How are we going to present to our brothers and sisters of Quebec the good news of Jesus Christ and invite them to become truly Christian from A to Z, to accept the gospel, to accept the way of life, new life in Jesus Christ. And that is where we're at right now, yeah.
And you've already started, haven't you? Because you're also a very media-savvy clergyman. even as a bishop, you were on Facebook. You are on Facebook.
Yes.
You have your Twitter feed.
Yes.
How do you see these new, so-called new means of communications, new media, as being a tool to reach out and do and achieve the, confront the challenges that face you?
Well, you know, this year we're celebrating the 50 years of the opening of the Vatican Council, the Second Vatican Council, which was an invitation to open the doors and open the windows to have a better dialogue with the world. Today, that's where the world is at, and we need to be. And I think the Holy Father is giving us the example. He himself is on Facebook and Twitter, and he uses social media to be in dialogue. What I really enjoy in these new social media is to be in contact with people who are outside our doors and outside our institutions and our parishes. Young people, many young people, and not so young, who will, through Twitter, through Facebook in a special way, chat with you for a few minutes. It's 3, 4, 5 sentences that you exchange, but it's an opportunity to enter into dialogue. The name of the game is dialogue. Building relationships, listening, encountering people where they are. I've seen also through these social media, when I invite to a special encounter, a special meeting, a special celebration, people answer. And people will come up to me at the end of an event and say, Archbishop, I came because you invited us on Facebook, on Twitter. I would have never have come. I haven't been to church in 10 years, in 20 years. This is my first experience. So I think it's a wonderful way to enter into dialogue. Of course, like anything else, you have to use it in a wise way. All good things need to be used wisely. And I mean, I can't be on Twitter or on Facebook hours and hours a day.
It's a full-time job.
Of course. You know, I'll take 10, 15 minutes or something in the evening or sometime in the day to go check and send a few messages. But I think we need to be where the people are. You know, Paul VI already said this many, many years ago. There was a time when we rang the bell and everybody came. Not anymore. We need to go out, outreach. Go where people are, enter into dialogue, see where they're at, and be able to establish relationship and present the one who is the way, the truth and the life, Jesus Christ. That's my passion and it's my life. And I'm blessed in our Archdiocese of Quebec to have a great team of men and women who want to continue to do this. Although the challenges are enormous, it's a wonderful life.
I have to end the interview commenting on your lapel symbol. Now, most bishops or archbishops I've ever met carry a cross on their lapel as a symbol of who they are and what they do. You don't have a cross in your lapel. You have a fish hook.
Yes. Well, see, I have a cross here in the chain around my neck, a big cross, actually. But yes, this is not only on my lapel. This fisherman's hook is also on my coat of arms. Jesus said to Peter, "I will make you a fisher of men." That's my full-time job, my friend, bringing people to Christ, bringing people to encounter the one who has changed my life, the one who brings new life. You know, it's not a net, it's not a fisherman's net, because with a fisherman's net, you catch fish. With a hook, you have to tease it and you have to attract it. And I think that's what a Christian should be out in the world, whether he be a member of a secular institute or out there in the world as baptized men and women. We have to attract people and invite them to meet our saving Lord. So I wear this proudly. It's a conversation piece. Like you asked me, many people everywhere as I go ask me, "What's that? Do you like fishing?" I says, "You bet I do." "You must not have time to go fishing, huh?" I says, "I do. It's a full-time job for me." So then we start talking, and it's a wonderful conversation piece.
Archbishop Gerald Lacroix of Quebec. Well, Canada doesn't just have a new archbishop. It has a new cardinal, too. Archbishop Thomas Collins of Toronto was raised a cardinal in the last consistory. He tells Emer McCarthy that one of the main challenges he sees to his mission of evangelization is brought on by an increasingly secular society which wants to marginalize faith in the public square.
The church has different situations in, around the world, but in the situation I face in Canada, and I think it may be similar to some degree in other parts, maybe Europe to some degree, and the United States, there is a kind of a form of secularism in which freedom of religion becomes freedom from religion. And a kind of a mindset which, in a sense, doesn't make much of a, you know, what kind of a contribution does it make to the broader society? Sort of wants to exclude the voice of religion, the voice of faith. Let it be excluded. Let it not speak in the public square. Let it stay back in a little home, shut the door, keep it away, keep it off the, you know, don't let it be appear in public. And I think that is not, I don't think that's right. I think we believers, and I speak of Christians, I speak of Catholic Christians, but I speak of also people of other faiths. People of faith contribute to society. If you are sick, if you are on the streets in Toronto, if you are suffering, the hand reaching out to help you will almost certainly be motivated by faith, by religious faith. And we participate in the society in a very profound way. And that's not the only reason why we have a right to be heard, but it is one reason. And I think that we Christians and also believers of other faiths, I think that's true as well, need to be part of the democratic conversation. And we have every right to be present in that, and we need to do that. We should not be given the idea, sorry, we should not accept the idea that our faith should be simply off on the side. It isn't a relevant issue. Our faith is a very relevant issue. And I think that people of faith, whether it be, like I just met a group of the Jewish community just a short time ago, fervent Jews, fervent Catholics disagree, obviously, on profoundly important issues, but we love and respect one another. And I remember I met a good friend of mine who was a new friend of mine. We went off to a little coffee shop, and I was sitting there. And there he had his kippah on as a Jewish, and I was at my Roman collar, my thing. We're sitting having coffee and just chatting away, and had a great time together. And somebody came in who looked at us and said, "Oh, this is a real amazing. I see a Jewish and Catholic priest talking together." And I said, "Well, not." We both looked at one another. Don't know what they meant, you know. So I think that the people who are really seem to be nervous are the secularists. they don't like these religious people. What's going on? And then they speak, of course, of how they're going to be, religious people be fighting one another. That's certainly not true in the situation I'm living in. It can be true, but then it's often caused by other factors, economic factors, where religion becomes a marker of a group in society, and then people fight on that thing. That can happen. But I think that it's also very real that believers work together and certainly contribute enormously to any society. So secularism, in the sense of exclusion of religion, is, I think, a dead end. It contributes nothing, and therefore that's not it. Secularism, in the sense of this age, as we used to say in Latin, per omnes secula secularum, for all the ages of the ages, that's all secular means, is of this age. And in this age, the voice of faith is alive, it's vibrant, it's contributing, it's life-giving, and therefore it has every right to contribute to the whole of society.
And a warm thanks there to Archbishop Thomas Collins, the new Cardinal of Toronto, Canada. They've topped the spectacular record of 5 million visitors, putting them on a par with the British Museum in London, the Prado in Madrid, and the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, to name just a few. Founded back in the 16th century by Pope Julius II, the Vatican Museums host some of the most famous works of early Christian, classical, and Renaissance art in the world. I asked art historian Elizabeth Lev what makes the Vatican Museums so special, besides, of course, Michelangelo's frescoes in the Sistine Chapel.
What the Vatican Museum has that really tops most places anywhere is a great deal of art in situ. I mean, one of the questions people ask the most is, so where'd all this stuff come from? Who'd you guys have to loot to get all this stuff? Well, the fact is that the Vatican Museums is one of the very few that never had to loot anybody, because given its age and given its collections, it's all things that were bought and paid for by the Pope. So you go into a space which are frescoed on the walls, decoration affixed to the walls by the popes who paid for the artists, selected the artists, oversaw the programs. And then you look at these incredible collections of antiquities, which are connected to the real live work the papacy did over the years to conserve the patrimony of Rome. They sponsored excavations, they restored buildings, and they amassed this, and some cardinals amassed great personal collections, which then they donated to the Vatican. So it's a really remarkable, remarkable story of a grouping together, a community of objects that is contained within those walls.
I mean, because Rome is full of beautiful villas, palazzi. I'm thinking of the Barberini Palace. You've got the Capitoline Museums. You've got incredible collections elsewhere. But the Vatican Museums, I don't know, with respect to those others that I just mentioned, I mean, are they getting far more visitors?
The Vatican Museums, the only thing that even remotely comes close is the Colosseum, which is just, it's the site of the Colosseum and the Forum contained together. But insofar as the Capitoline Museums, which actually are the oldest public museum in the world, they antedate the Vatican Museums. They were opened by Pope Sixtus IV. While he was building the Sistine Chapel, he was also putting works of art on display. So again, the papacy's interest in making sure the people of Rome would have access to art and to really remember its great former glory and to try to restore that glory to Rome. The Barberini Palace, for example, is a family collection. And so they're two very different, it's now a state museum, of course, but they're two very different types of collections. The Capitoline was always the repository of the ancient works of art. And then later on, there was a picture gallery from the 17th century. It's got some stuff that's not just antiquities, but it was really principally designed to be a repository for great antique art. Particularly in the 16th century, when the Vatican Museums came under heavy fire by sort of the general public because of the incredible number of pagan statuary that was collected, you know, a stone's throw from the Pope's house. So in order to preserve these works but not have that collection with the successor or that connection with the successor of St. Peter, they took those works and they moved them into this other museum sitting on top of the hill of Temple of Jupiter, Best and Greatest, and kind of separated its sort of pagan holdings from the more Christian holdings. In the case of the Barberini or the Borghese or the Spada or the many other wonderful museums of that sort, you deal with a collection that's based on the story of a family. And the family, which are usually papal or cardinalate families, they're very important. They're reflections of the time they're in. They're extremely interesting from the point of view of collectionism, and they often have spectacular works of art. But they tend to be connected to specifically that reality of that family. When you are in the Vatican Museums, you are dealing with the reality of the Roman Church. And so the collection also reflects that transition from the pagan culture that tried so hard to wipe out Christianity and then became Christian to this 2,000-year-old message of the gospel that the Church has been transmitting in every way it can possibly think of.
The reality of the Vatican Museums today is that they're getting 5 million people perhaps a year. What challenges does that pose to the museums and the direction of it?
Well, to begin with, 5 million was it translated into many, 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 many just plain old difficult days in the museums. The museums, that structure was not designed originally as a museum. There are very few parts of it that were designed as museum galleries. And of course, being limited to Vatican City, there's only so much space they can possibly use. Some of the most important rooms, the rooms that are the most visited in the Vatican Museums, the Sistine Chapel, the Raphael rooms, were never meant to hold 15,000, 20,000 visitors a day. The Vatican Museums had already been pushing about 4.1, 4.2 million, but last year just knocked it out of the park with this 5 million, which is a number that is bad for the works of art, because simply the heat and the moisture and the humidity, mm-hmm, and the simple sort of human acidity that is in these rooms. It's very difficult to protect these works of art. Unfortunately, you know, I would love to be able to tell you that those 5 million visitors are respectful for the antiquity, the venerability, the beauty, the age, the importance of those works. But, you know, I am invariably amazed at how much disrespect people show to a space like that. I mean, it never fails to leave me a little perplexed to see when people leave the Sistine Chapel all the garbage that people leave strewn in the Sistine Chapel.
What?
I mean, just, oh yes, every day the custodians of the Sistine Chapel, soon as everybody leaves, they have to pick up people's water bottles and candy bar wrappers
oh,
and
my goodness.
Garbage they throw on the floor. It's an amazing thing. So yes, there are plenty of challenges. Also, in just simply making these people comfortable. How do you make this visit something that is not just herded through like cattle? How does this end up meaning anything to anyone? It's just a traipse in one door, traipse out the other. And a traipse is an optimistic word. It's really more like a shuffle.
Well, you're mentioning the Sistine Chapel, which is one of the biggest attractions, of course, of the museums. We've also have the Raphael stanzas. What are some of the other things, perhaps, that go missed or that are a bit lesser known, let's say some of the treasures of the museums?
I think there are two aspects of the museums that are kind of lost in this modern type of tourism that has affected the museums. One, there are simply smaller. I remember 13 years ago when I started doing tours and visiting the museums, I remember this time, the winter months when it's a little quieter, you could go into the Nicolaitan Chapel, painted by Fra Angelico. You could go into a lot of little small, tiny, the little mosaic room, which John Paul II gave with micro mosaics. These rooms were open, and you could sort of step off into them and kind of get away from, have these little secluded private moments. Those have had to be closed because you cannot count on people's good sense to not march into a very small space with, you know, 50 people who are going to brush up against the works of art. But there are also things, because people approach the Vatican Museums with such a priority mentality, just, I have to get to the Sistine Chapel and maybe the Laocoon in the ancient sculpture collection and then tick, tick out. They miss some of the really unique things about that museum. The Vatican Museums has a museum of early Christian art, which is unique in the world. There is only one museum of Paleo-Christian sculpture in the world, and it is in the Vatican Museums. It is large. It is well arranged. There's never anybody there, and it's very easy to understand. Once you look through that museum and you see all the stories of Daniel, of Adam and Eve, of Jonah, of Noah, all of a sudden, the program of the Sistine Chapel is already there. So you find out that what Michelangelo was painting 1,200 years later was already being carved by the first Christian sculptors, you know, as soon as they were allowed to.
If I'm not mistaken, that particular the early Christian exhibit is right before you get into the Sistine Chapel. Is that right?
Oh, there are two sections. Mm-hmm. There's an offshoot of the early Christian mm-hmm. museum, which is where you find the objects from the catacombs. And the way that most visitors go today, you come out of the museums and then you go through that section. The early Christian, the actual, it's in a building constructed in the 1970s, together with what's called the Gregorian Profane Museum. So it's actually a very brilliant design where you walk through it when it's all open. You walk through a section of pagan antique art, and then you climb a set of stairs, and you end up in Christian art. And you see how Christians borrow motifs from the pagans, but they perfect them, and they make them really they aren't simply just slapping a new name on an old face. They're taking an idea, and they perfect the idea. And so it's over immediately by the end exit. So either people pass it while they're going out, and they're too tired after the visit to even stop. Or what I would usually do, what I'd like to do, is to just go there immediately, just sort of cut right around and go straight there, so that already we understand the language of the Sistine Chapel. We understand the language of art of the church before you even get started.
It's quite astonishing to see sometimes hundreds and hundreds of people standing in line along the outside of the Vatican walls there, waiting to get into the museums in the rain, in the 90-degree heat. What would you suggest to people who are planning a trip to the Vatican Museums?
Well, I would say I just would like to briefly mention that I see the same lines over at Disney and the same lines over for people will stand in line for. I see those lines standing outside a Gucci store when there's a sale on. So people seem to be willing to stand in line if it's important to them. The Vatican Museums, however, a few years back implemented a very efficient reservation system. It's €4 on the ticket, so it does involve a fee, but the fact is that you can reserve online. The Vatican website will take you right to the museums. The museum website will take you to an online ticket booth. You print out your reservation. You walk to the front of the line and you walk on in. Any individual can do it. And you know, if you use a little bit of good sense and don't choose the time when obviously everybody likes to go to the museum, which is 10 o'clock, you really will just ease your way in.
And that does not mean that necessarily that you have to take a tour, a pre-organized tour.
It doesn't require a tour. It's just your entry ticket. You can also book a tour, and that kind of thinking ahead will save you from the rather parasitical event of being in the line with a whole bunch of people who know that you didn't get your act together, you didn't pick up your ticket, and they're sitting there, skip the line. You get pulled out of the line, you get put into some other group, you wait 45 minutes, you go in with this huge group of people, you get a very bad tour, and you scratch your head, and you blame the Vatican Museums. I mean, just it's very easy to work around this. Mm.
Okay, and of course you can also add on a tour of the Basilica of St. Peter's.
Yes. There is in the Vatican Museums, particularly under the Art and Faith section, they do put together both a tour. It can be led by many religious sisters that do this. There's an order that dedicates itself to these art and faith tours, and the missionaries of the Divine Revelation, who have green habits, very, very distinctive, they will take you not only through the museums, but they will also take you into St. Peter's Basilica, I mean, provided the Holy Father isn't using it.
Mm-hmm. It's important to note for our listeners that also the Vatican Museums, at certain times during the year, it opens up at nighttime as well. And also there are some tours available, at least in Italian, for deaf people and blind people as well.
Yes, the Vatican Museum, it has, as one of the top 10 visited museums in the world, it really does try to keep up, and it actually has always been, traditionally, it's been ahead of the curve. They had a handicapped access before anybody else even thought of it. The Vatican Museums, now for the Romans, to really try to encourage the Romans to come, because no Roman will set foot in there with the chaos, they open up on Friday nights during the nice months, and you can visit those museums the same way that Goethe did in the 18th century. By candlelight, with some of these works illuminated by candlelight. There are actually special tours for children and for deaf people, as well as for blind people, in which you can, certain works have been reproduced in three-dimensional form so that they can get a sense of what a Caravaggio painting feels like.
And a warm thanks there to Elizabeth Lev, a professor of Christian art and architecture at Duquesne University. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening. Laudator Jesus Christus.